them to Germany in the event of a Soviet invasion into Western Europe. It generally ran 2 weeks and was conducted across the frozen German landscape, particularly in areas where we actually expected to fight. It included hundreds of units throughout Europe. But the Pentagon also brought over to Europe thousands of military personnel from the United States who utilized pre-stored equipment such as tanks and artillery.
It was just before one of these annual exercises that our brigade received a new commander. Colonel John Petraka was a hard, no-nonsense trainer and experienced warfighter who made some people nervous in his presence, with his patent S persona. Prior to the large winter exercise, Colonel Petraka assembled the 9 tank company commanders in his brigade to teach us how to evaluate the ability of a tank to cross underclassed bridges.
Tanks weigh more than 50 tons, and many of the bridges in Germany are marked for lesser weight. This training was an intersection of physics, risk assessment, and safety that most of us didn't fully appreciate prior to his class. But we followed his guidance and prevailed in the exercise without breaking any bridges, damaging any tanks, or injuring any soldiers.
I'll never know whether his techniques for crossing these bridges actually weakened any of them, but having served in Germany for decades afterwards, I've not heard of a single bridge collapse resulting from a tank crossing done the Petraka way. And we were training for war, so knowing what bridges would support tanks and what bridges would not was key to our plans. Prior to this exercise, Colonel Petraka also challenged each and every one of his 30-plus company-sized units to take every major piece of equipment into the field and bring it all back under its own power.
He told us that any company that accomplished this would receive a 4-day weekend and the bragging rights that came with it. A typical company had anywhere from 20 to 30 vehicles. Mine had 17 tanks and a half dozen other support vehicles. As it turned out, my company was one of the few to meet this challenge. But that brought more attention my way, which I wasn't sure I really wanted.
From that point forward, Colonel Petraka gave me and my company more attention than I was looking for. To me, it felt like we became the new standard that he charged others to meet. A few months after the exercise, I was walking out of my tank park one evening and Colonel Petraka's car pulled up. He rolled down his window and said, "Craig, tomorrow your company is going to be inspected by the division's MATE team, and you're going to show everyone how to pass." MATE stood for Maintenance, Assistance, and Inspection Team, and these visits brought with them standards almost nobody could meet.
No company in our brigade had passed this inspection in a very long time. This was considered a no-notice inspection, given that I had only 12 hours to prepare. It was 6 p.m. now, and at 6 a.m. the following morning, a dozen inspectors would be climbing all over my company's tanks.
That was a long night, but we passed the inspection, and I can still feel the clap of Colonel Petraka's hand on the back of my neck as he stood me in front of 30-plus of my fellow company commanders to demonstrate to them that it could be done. I was proud of my team, but also a bit embarrassed by the adulation. Nevertheless, I learned valuable lessons from Colonel Petraka during these months.
My confidence rose that day as I came to understand that delivering under pressure is what distinguishes great leaders from, well, so-so leaders.
I learned another lesson about delivering results in another reforger exercise a year or so later. My company had just implemented the tank crossing technique taught to us by Colonel Petraka to surreptitiously make our way through the enemy's defenses and get behind their front lines, where we would wreak havoc in their rear area.
I was very proud of my team that day, but an observing general officer from the U.S. mainland zeroed in on the fact that some of my soldiers did not have the right uniform on, and our tank tarps were flapping in the wind as they went by. He reported his observation of this sloppy-looking tank company, which eventually found its way back to me. No mention was made of our tactical success. This was an example of what I later dubbed "be good, look good," an approach I incorporated into my philosophy of command. See Appendix A, regarding pride in one's work and the work environment.
It reminds me of the uniform standards General Patton demanded of his troops, even in combat during World War II. A clean and orderly work environment raises pride and a sense of ownership by the people who work there. Whether in a military environment or in the corporate world, people perform better when they and their work environment are held in high standards of appearance and organization. First impressions actually do count, I learned. The risk for leaders is to ensure that you aren't covering up rust with paint, or making work for work's sake. I've seen that phenomenon, and it is counterproductive. You must create a culture in which people take pride in their work, their environment, and themselves. The organization will be better off as a result, believe me. In my career, I have encountered many leaders who taught me the value of having pride in one's work. Key among these was Colonel Petraka. Though initially unnerved by his style of leadership, I ultimately became inspired by him and learned over time what he was doing and why. Throughout my time as a company commander, he often tested and evaluated me as a leader. Once he sought me out during a major field exercise at Hohenfels training area, and got into my tank when I crossed the line of departure on a simulated nighttime attack. For the next 5 to 6 hours, he was just 2 feet away in the loader's hatch, never saying much, just observing and listening to how I commanded my company. When we arrived on the objective near dawn the next morning, he disembarked, simply saying, "Have a great day." For all the angst this senior-level commander created among junior officers, he was a demanding but fair taskmaster and leader. Those who understood this succeeded. Those who shrank from it did not. While his leadership style was different from my own, it worked, and I truly appreciate the time I had him as a mentor and commander. He was a true warrior, a very capable leader, and a fine man. Sadly, I learned that a few years after his retirement from the Army, he was killed in a hunting accident, but the legacy of and lessons learned from his leadership have carried with me to this day.
Chapter 5. Effective Communications.
It's not what we say that matters. It's what the other person hears. Author unknown. In the summer of 1980, after 3 years in Germany, I moved to Washington, D.C. It was the start of the Reagan years, with a resurgence in national pride in the American military. I was an assignment officer in the Armor Branch, responsible for the professional development and assignment of junior armor officers across the globe, the same job Tom Montgomery had when I met him 3 years earlier. This gave me exposure to the personnel files of my contemporaries, and I was charged with making decisions on assignments that would, first and foremost, fulfill Army requirements, but could also help or hinder their career paths. The conundrum facing assignment officers like me was that we had to be mindful of a key principle. Army requirements are a higher priority than the personal or professional development of the officer corps. We had to accept that not everyone could have a career-enhancing posting. This made for difficult decisions, as I felt a great responsibility to choose the right officers for each assignment, while also never taking into account personal relationships. I was also very aware that following my duty in Washington, I would be returning to the field to serve with many of the same officers for whom I had made career-impacting decisions. I was committed to be fair and honest with each and every one of them, so they knew I did my best on both counts. I had to ensure I could look myself in the mirror every day, and that years later, I could also look them in the eye and feel that same confidence. It was during this tour, communicating to armor officers all over the world, that I started to be more aware of everything I said or wrote. This is where I started to hone the skill of connecting to my audience. I learned that a key to effective communication is understanding, before you transmit, how your audience will receive your message. Whether engaging a single individual or an audience of 1,000, it is essential to connect to them in terms they best understand. It doesn't matter if it is a 20 or a 60-year-old, a male or female, a private or general, an American or a foreigner, a liberal or a conservative, a CEO or a line worker. If you first figure out how to best connect to others in terms they best understand, you have the greatest chance of success. I now analyze my audiences and have practiced this technique for years. When I'm invited to speak to a group and preparation time allows for it, I study my audience in depth. For example, in a recent 6-year period, I was a senior mentor for a Department of Defense course called the Executive Leader Development Program. In this role, I traveled once a year as part of a group of highly motivated, smart, and ambitious Department of Defense civilians and military members. I would spend a week in far-flung locations with them, mentoring and advising both small groups and individuals. At the beginning of each trip, I would give a talk called A Potpourri of Thoughts on Leadership and Other Stuff. I studied the students' biographies ahead of time to find any connections I might have with them. I then selected a half dozen of them and placed their names randomly among the slides I was showing during my talk. Whenever a slide came up with someone's name on it, I would ask them to stand, and I would convey to the group what we had in common. I would announce this up front so the students would not be surprised. This accomplished two things. It obviously kept the audience awake during my presentation, anxious to see if their name was on a slide. But more importantly, it allowed me to connect with them in a more personal way, demonstrating that I cared enough to study them ahead of time. Understanding your audience, then communicating to them in terms they best understand, is an essential skill of an effective leader. Without it, the leadership mountain is a much steeper climb. Knowing your audience is especially important in written communications when body language, facial expression, tone, and verbal inflections and intensity cannot be observed. Whenever writing, it's best to start with a first draft, what General Stan McChrystal calls the 30% solution, because there's another 70% of fine-tuning still to be done. If time allows, let your draft sit a few hours, then return to it and self-edit your writing, improving it as much as you can. It always gets better when you reread your work and do further editing. Anytime that you have a strong emotion associated with your written message, it's best to let it sit overnight before pushing send. Come back to it later, when the drama is less, as this will give you the opportunity to repackage it in a way that will usually be better received, while not diluting the impact of your original intent. Years ago, "read back for a possible correction" was a critical refrain on tactical radios in the military. This referred to having the receiver repeat the message to ensure it was fully understood and there would be no confusion over a radio. I continue to follow this rule when it comes to any communicating I do. Time permitting, it's helpful to read back to myself what I intend to say, whether verbally or in writing, before doing so. This is a case where patience pays.
Chapter 6. Know Your Working Style and Those Around You.
In the progress of personality, first comes a declaration of independence, then a recognition of interdependence. Henry Van Dyke. When people speak of diversity, they are usually referring to race, gender, ethnicity, age, and sometimes nationality. All are important, but there's another form of diversity that I suggest leaders pay attention to: personality type. People vary extensively in their personality types, and having such diversity in an organization or on a team usually pays off with better results. There are numerous tests to assess personality type, but I've come to appreciate and use the well-known and generally accepted Myers-Briggs type indicator, MBTI, I first took the MBTI when I was a student at Fort Leavenworth, attending the Army's Command and General Staff College, a graduate-level professional development training course for majors. Established in 1881 by General William Tecumseh Sherman, the institution was initially the School of Application for Infantry and Cavalry. The historic Army post sits on the bluffs of the Missouri River, just north of Kansas City. One of the great benefits of this one-year academic sabbatical is the opportunity to spend time with 800 contemporaries and learn from them. These are the leaders of tomorrow's Army. Relationships forged there endure for decades. While I was in this program, I was also earning a master's degree at Knights in Kansas City. So this year truly tested my commitment to improving myself. The MBTI is often used in both the federal government and in the business sector to help people identify the nature of their own personality type and accompanying strengths and weaknesses. It also helps one to understand other people's personalities as well. So, as a leader, you can maximize their strengths and mitigate their weaknesses. Whether in the military or in the corporate world, it is the strength of the whole that pushes organizations to their best results. Having diverse personality types can make a team exponentially more effective by drawing the very best skills out of each and every member to benefit the whole. I've taken the MBTI half a dozen times over the years, and it always shows that I am an ISTJ, introversion, sensing, thinking, and judgment. My personality type is generally described as serious and quiet, earn success by concentration and thoroughness, practical, orderly, matter of fact, logical, realistic, and dependable, takes responsibility, makes up his own mind as to what should be accomplished, and works toward it steadily, regardless of protest or distraction. Myers-Briggs has 16 different profiles with different combinations of personality traits. For example, the opposite of introversion, I, is extroversion, E. The opposite of sensors, S, is intuitive, N. The opposite of thinkers, T, are feelers, F. And the opposite of judgers, J, are perceivers, P. You can see how these can be mixed and matched to arrive at 16 different combinations. Further, there are ranges or degrees of each type. For example, you can be at the far end of the spectrum for introversion, or closer to the middle, where you might show extroversion in some instances. I happen to be at the far end of introversion. But the other components of my profile, the S, T, and J, give me the ability to be extroverted when a particular task calls for it, like public speaking, a skill not normally associated with an introvert. A friend once told me he was one of five company commanders in a particular unit, and his boss didn't understand why he was not connecting well with his junior leaders. He made them all take a Myers-Briggs test, and he learned that they were all extroverts, while he was an introvert. From that point on, communications improved because they better understood each other, and he took their personality differences into account when he communicated with them. Understanding the nature of different personalities on your team is one of the rocks you need in your leadership backpack. It would be a boring world if everyone thought and acted the same, as well as a less productive and less innovative one. There is strength in diverse personalities, just as there are strengths in other forms of diversity. Do you know your profile? Have you ever had an assessment to better understand your own personality style? What about the styles of those around you? Your performance as a leader will improve if you know more about the operating style of the people you lead. Check it out. You can take the test in 30 minutes online at www.mbtionline.com.
Generational diversity.
Finally, it is equally important to understand distinctions between generational groups, starting with baby boomers, born between the early to mid-1940s and ending between 1960 to 1964. Members of this large post-World War II group are now becoming senior citizens. I know, because I'm one of them, and I'm starting to feel my age. The next group is Generation X, born between the early to mid-1960s and the early 1980s. Following them are millennials, typically born in a window between the early 80s and the mid-90s to early 2000s. Research indicates that this group will have 73 million members by 2019, surpassing the baby boomers in size. Generation Z, also called the postmillennials, homeland generation, or plurals, is the cohort of people who followed the millennials, born between the mid-1990s to the mid-2000s. All were shaped by both the environment in which they were raised and by the nurture and influence, or lack of, by parents, educators, coaches, and peers. Because these factors evolved so substantially over the 50 to 60 year period in question, there are great variations in outcomes regarding how each group thinks, acts, conducts themselves, the depth of their work ethic, and their expectations from society and of themselves. Too much for this book to undertake, a good primer on better understanding generational differences is The Generational Imperative by Chuck Underwood. And because leaders often find themselves leading people with both personality and generational differences, it argues for the strong leader to study both. I can assure you, the military is doing so, and the corporate world would be wise to do so as well.
Chapter 7. Loyalty is a Two-Way Street.
If I have seen further, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants. Sir Isaac Newton. In the summer of 1987, I became the chief of cavalry doctrine at Fort Knox, responsible for writing and revising all the training and doctrinal manuals for the armored cavalry forces of the Army. This is when I first met Lieutenant Colonel Jerry Wallace Thurman, better known as JW. He was my immediate boss and a legend in Armor Branch. Having earned the Distinguished Service Cross for bravery, one level below the Medal of Honor, as a helicopter pilot in Vietnam, he was cut from the same cloth as a character from the 1979 movie Apocalypse Now, the irreverent story about the Vietnam War, starring Martin Sheen and Robert Duvall, as Lieutenant Colonel Bill Kilgore, the eccentric cavalryman. J.W. was Kilgore, the bare-chested, Stetson-wearing commander who surfed behind a patrol boat on the Mekong Delta River. Never politically correct, his was a unique style of leadership, one that would be difficult for me to replicate. But I carry some of his leadership rocks in my backpack. One of his most endearing qualities was an intense loyalty to his troops. J.W. retired as a colonel and stayed at Fort Knox, where he spent a number of years mentoring tomorrow's armor and cavalry leaders. Regrettably, he passed away a few years ago, but his legacy, and particularly the fervent loyalty to the thousands of soldiers he touched, survived and has made us all better for it. I first met J.W.'s younger brother, Major James David Thurman, during this tour. He is known as J.D. and was at Fort Hood, Texas, when I was at Fort Knox, working for his older brother. He, too, was an armor and cavalry officer, and like his brother, a pilot. J.D. and I would serve together a few years later in Germany and became good friends. He rose to become the commander of all forces in Korea when he retired as a four-star general in 2013. Ironically, my adopting of J.W.'s commitment to loyalty to his team was tested later in my career. In November of 2009, the Marine Corps announced the creation of a new Senior Executive Service, SES, position in Hawaii, to oversee bases and stations in the Pacific, and the move of thousands of Marines from Okinawa to Guam and other locations. I was living in Florida at the time, but my wife and I were anxious to return to Hawaii, so I applied for the job. About mid-January of 2010, I received a phone call from the Marine Corps. They asked if I could come to Quantico, Virginia, for an interview near the end of the month. I went and was interviewed by two Marine Corps Brigadier Generals and a member of the Senior Executive Service. 20 minutes before the interview, I was provided a list of questions I was told they would ask. This wasn't expected, but I appreciated the opportunity to wrap my head around the questions and formulate a response to each. When I went in, they dutifully asked each of the questions, and I responded. But once done with the questions on the list, one of them asked, "What would you say to the selecting official if you had him alone for 30 seconds in an elevator?" I responded that I would not repeat what was already in my application, since I would assume he had already reviewed it. I said, "I would invite him to speak to anyone who I have worked for, has worked with me, or has worked for me. They all will say the same thing about Craig Weldon." I wanted to assure these board members that they would find no one who would characterize me as treating superiors one way and subordinates another. I have worked for people like that, and it was never pleasant. I was confident enough in the answer to this question that I was happy to put this challenge out to them. I returned to Florida, and a few days later I received a call from Hawaii. They asked if I could do a telephone interview on 7 February with Lieutenant General Keith Stalder, the commander of U.S. Marine Corps Forces Pacific. I said I certainly could, but by coincidence, I would be arriving in Hawaii on 6 February, on a 2-week vacation visiting my son, who was a college student there. I said I'd be happy to meet with him face to face. Surprised to hear this, they said they'd get back to me the following day. When I hung up, my spirits were up. I had apparently done well enough in the panel interview that I was now at the next level of the application. The next day, the phone rang, and it was the same person. "No," he said, "a telephone interview is all that's needed." As I hung up, I turned to my wife and told her that I didn't believe I had gotten the job. "Why in the world would they not take advantage of a face-to-face interview?" I asked myself. I later learned that the organization was trying to set the same conditions for all of the final candidates, and since others would not have a face-to-face interview, neither should I. As planned, my wife and I flew to Hawaii on 6 February 2010. The morning after our arrival, I received a call from General Stalder. He didn't inquire about my job qualifications and, in fact, joked about the fact that he wasn't sure what to ask since he had never hired an SES before. I told him that was okay, because I had never been an SES before, so I probably didn't know the answers anyway. He laughed. Our conversation was really just a chemistry check. At the end of the interview, he asked me if I wanted to leave anything with him. I told him the panel had asked what I would say to him if we found ourselves in an elevator together, and then told him my answer. He laughed again and said the board members had passed that on to him. Almost 2 months went by, and I didn't hear anything. I was sure I hadn't been selected. Finally, the phone rang on April 1st, and I was informed that I had been tentatively selected. "What does that mean?" I asked. The fellow on the other end of the line said there were 3 more gates I'd have to get through. Concurrence from the Assistant Commandant of the Marine Corps, approval from the Undersecretary of the Navy, and validation from a board of senior executives that I was qualified to serve in their ranks. He told me not to worry. Most of these should be easy, as the first two would likely accept the recommendation of General Stalder, and I should breeze through the board review, since I had already served 7 years as an active duty general officer. Finally, in early May, I was notified that I had been officially selected, and I could negotiate a report date with Marine Corps Forces Pacific. In the end, I'm confident my loyalty, both up and down the chain of command, paid off. My point is simply that loyalty is a two-way street. Bipolar leadership is toxic and destructive and should be uncovered early on. This is one reason why more and more organizations are now doing 360-degree evaluations, including the military, to ensure they know what they're getting in a senior leader. It doesn't matter if you are dealing with people higher up the command chain or those lower than you. Everyone should be treated with respect, dignity, and appreciation for what they do. You've probably heard that saying, what you see is what you get. In my case, that was and remains true, and I value it in others as well.
Chapter 8, Setting Organizational Expectations.
High achievement always takes place in the framework of high expectation. Charles F. Kettering.
I was at Fort Knox, Kentucky in 1989 when I was promoted to lieutenant colonel and took command of 2nd Battalion, 10th Cavalry, and the 194th Separate Armor Brigade, the largest brigade in the Army. The 194th was part of the 18th Airborne Corps. Also part of the 18th Airborne Corps were the 82nd Airborne Division, based at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, the 101st Air Assault Division at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and the 24th Infantry Division at Fort Stewart, Georgia. We were the Corps' heavy, ready brigade, meaning we were subject to short notification and deployment if called up. I took the flag of command in July 1989, and that very same day, Command Sergeant Major Jerry Utterback joined me as my senior enlisted advisor and command team partner. After the change of command, we sat down for our first meeting, and I told the Sergeant Major that this relationship was relatively new to me. I had served with Command Sergeant's Major before, but had never had one reporting directly to me. He said, "Sir, that's fine. I've never been a Sergeant Major before. We'll go on this journey and learn together." I laughed, and it was clear we would get along great. In retrospect, it now reminds me of the phone interview I had with General Stalder, discussed in the last chapter. Chemistry counts when you're a senior leader. Jerry Utterback was with me to the end of my command 2 years later, and eventually became the Command Sergeant Major for the Armor School before retiring. He was a great soldier, and we remain close to this day. I was also blessed to have another great enlisted leader in my ranks during those years. Command Sergeant Major Jack Tilley was our Brigade Sergeant Major. Sergeant Major Tilley rose to become the senior enlisted soldier in our Army, Sergeant Major of the Army. Both these great soldiers validated for me what I already knew. The key role non-commissioned officers, sergeants, play in making the United States military the best in the world. Because officers plan and decide, and sergeants implement and supervise. The key difference between us and much of the rest of the world is that our officers place enormous trust and faith in their non-commissioned officers, NCOs, because they've earned it. As a leader, I knew that my instructions were being carried out. And when things didn't work out as planned, sergeants adapted because they understood the commander's original intent and goals. That's not the case with many other militaries around the world, I've learned. And that's what sets us apart. I address this in Chapter 2, when contrasting the Hungarian Army with the U.S. Army in the early 90s.
Being upfront about your expectations.
In the military, newly appointed commanders at the battalion or squadron level and above assume responsibility for an organization of at least 500, but often in the thousands. They typically remain in charge for 2 years or maybe three, but no more. It's their job to set the course and then lead while they are stewards of the ship. Occasionally, I've had a new boss who didn't tell us what he thought was important, what his priorities were, or what his personal quirks were. This leads to frustration, and the staff and subordinate units often struggled, sometimes for months, trying to figure out exactly what he really wanted. I suggest that a leader's job in business is similar. A boss needs to set expectations, explain a vision, guide the development of a plan, then oversee its execution. He also needs to school his organization on how he operates as a leader, so there are few surprises. To ensure I didn't make this mistake before I took command of the 10th Cavalry, I sat down at my kitchen table with a pen and a yellow legal pad. This was prior to having a personal computer in every household. And I wrote out my philosophy of command. See Appendix A. I wanted to ensure that, from the first day, my soldiers understood what I believed to be important, what was less consequential, and what was non-negotiable. Written 30 years ago, the foundational principles outlined in this document guide my thinking to this day. Here's the last paragraph. Finally, unit identity is very important to me. I am very proud to be a soldier, and I am honored to be your commander. This is our battalion, not mine. I have only been given stewardship for the next 2 years. My regimental affiliation is the 10th Cavalry, and there is nowhere I would rather be. I look forward to a very challenging and rewarding 2 years. I'll do my best to make sure they are the same for you. A few years later, I took charge of a very different type of organization, this time in Germany. I was now a colonel and was selected to command a base spread over 7 different communities that supported over 45,000 military, family members, and other constituents. I discussed in Chapter 2 how I learned to trust my 3,000 employees. Because my command was made up of mostly civilians of mixed gender, not just men this time, and half were German nationals, I found a need to communicate to this very different workforce in a different way. But still, I needed to tell them what I thought was important and how I operated. Again, I wrote down what I wanted to achieve. Like my philosophy of command, written years before, this document aimed to let this new organization know what I thought was critical to our work versus what was less consequential. I also developed a short slide presentation to introduce myself, which I called Weldon on Weldon. See Appendix B in the print version of this audiobook. To tell them a bit about me so they wouldn't spend months trying to figure out what I thought was important versus not so important. I was comfortable enough in my own skin to point out on one of the slides what I thought were my strengths and my weaknesses. On one of the slides, two of the points I made were, I follow the rules, and I tend to show all my cards. Depending on whom you talk to, these can be viewed as either a strength or a weakness, but I wanted everyone to know up front how I viewed things. As a new leader, I suggest you not wait for people to figure out what makes you tick. Tell them early and often what's important. Give them your vision. Set a course. Oversee implementation and lead. If you have a pet peeve, let everyone know so there are no surprises. Tell them how you operate. I once worked for a boss whose staff meetings were regularly held at 9 a.m. On the first such meeting, he showed up at about 8:55 and just sat at the end of the long table, saying nothing. A few staff members were already there and others straggled in. But at precisely 9 a.m., he told someone to lock the door. Two staff officers had not come into the room. In so doing, he made his point. Those officers learned the hard way that timeliness was important to him, though I wonder if there wasn't a better way for him to make this point. Finally, have you ever worked for someone who tries to change the organization right at the outset to shape it to fit their mold? I'm reminded of a quote, often attributed to a Roman general from over 2,000 years ago. We had trained well, but it seemed that every time we were beginning to form up into teams, we reorganized. I was to learn later in life that we tend to meet any new situation by reorganizing. And a wonderful method it can be for creating the illusion of progress while producing confusion, inefficiency, and demoralizing the troops. New leaders shouldn't make changes for change's sake right out of the chute, unless you've been given a mandate for change, or organizational dysfunction is obvious. Assume the organization is working well and join their team. After an initial assessment period of perhaps 60 to 90 days, Change is then fair game. After all, you are the leader, and you are responsible for the ultimate success of those being led. Changing things at the very outset can often be viewed by the organization as a lack of trust, or that you think it's dysfunctional or broken.
The importance of delegating.
Lieutenant Colonel Command is typically the first time an officer has a large enough organization to warrant a staff. Delegation and time management become even more important. The more senior you become, the broader the responsibilities and organizational span of control you have. Yet there's still only 24 hours in a day. How do you keep everything moving forward? In a word, delegate. An excellent article from the November-December 1999 issue of the Harvard Business Review entitled Management Time, Who's Got the Monkey? Found on the web, relates the story of a leader who organizes his time to the minute. He makes lists, sharpens and lines up his pencils, and gets to the bottom of his inbox before the end of every day. Sounds like an ISTJ to me. Midweek, one of his subordinates comes in with a difficult problem and asks the leader for help. Because the leader is busy, he tells him to send me a memo on that. He then adds that task to his now growing list of things to do. This happens three more times before the end of the week. And on Friday, his inbox is overflowing. Frustrated that he's off his carefully managed schedule and anxious to get it back on track, he decides to go home Friday night, spend quality time with his family, and return Saturday to catch up. The next day, he drives back to work, passing a local golf course. Turning his head slightly, he sees his four subordinates on the first tee box, getting ready to play a round. What happened? When the four subordinates came into his office the previous week, they shifted the monkeys on their back to their leader's back. When subordinates come to me with a problem that I believe they can and should solve, I'm happy to provide input, but I make it clear that they own the monkey. If they need help, I'm there, but I'm not the action officer. In the military, there is a process called the Military Decision-Making Process, or MDMP. This seven-step process can work in the corporate world or in everyday life. It includes, number one, receipt, or issuance, of a mission. Number two, analysis. Number three, course of action, COA, development. Number four, COA analysis, aka wargaming. Number five, COA comparison. Number six, COA approval. Number seven, orders production, dissemination, and transition. Typically, a leader is most engaged at steps one and six. What the four subordinates in the Harvard Business Review article did was bring their issues back to the leader at step two. With 30 years in an Army uniform and another 9 as a senior executive with the Marine Corps, I understand this process well and have used it many times for even simple decisions at home. It is perfectly adaptable to the corporate world as well. Done enough times, it becomes like muscle memory and is easily incorporated into your daily decision-making. I can assure you that it will give back perhaps the most important resource you have as a senior leader, time.
Chapter 9. Breaking Down Cultural Barriers.
You cannot exaggerate about the Marines. They are convinced to the point of arrogance that they are the most ferocious fighters on Earth. And the amusing thing about it is that they are. Father Kevin Kearney, 1st Marine Division Chaplain, Korean War. Every organization has its own unique culture, derived from explicit and implicit rules about how to behave,
talk to others, and get things done. When you are new to an organization, it can be difficult to understand and appreciate this new culture, how it works, and how you fit in. Adapting to a new culture is a process many leaders will face when they change jobs or find themselves leading an organization whose culture differs from where they came from. I addressed this in a previous chapter when I was selected to command a base after having spent almost 20 years in tank and cavalry units. I've also had the unique opportunity to adapt from one service culture to another, from the Army to the Marine Corps. In 2010, I became the Executive Director of Marine Corps Forces Pacific, a job I held for more than 9 years. I was the senior civilian Marine between the Mississippi River and Korea. While some responsibilities were similar to what I had done in the Army, working in the Marine Corps required some adaptation. I was in the same church, but in a different pew. A very different pew. The position was created to provide executive-level oversight of an $8.7 billion program to build a new base in Guam, the largest such action for the Marine Corps since World War II. The job was framed around management of the bases in the Pacific, but with a special focus on facilitating the move of over 8,500 Marines and 9,000 family members from Okinawa to Guam. I applied for the job, was hired, and started in June 2010. It was a new position, so there was no continuity file of previous work to go by, and the expectations were not completely clear to me at the beginning. Meeting with my new boss, Lieutenant General Stalder, on my second day at Camp Smith in Hawaii, I told him I understood the job had a lot to do with the building of the new base in Guam and the move of the Marines from Okinawa. He confirmed this and mentioned that if he had it his way, the position would have been located in Guam. I replied that if it was based out of Guam, I wouldn't have even known about it, as my job search had only looked for opportunities in Hawaii. Nevertheless, it was clear I would spend quite a bit of time in Guam, something I hadn't expected when I lifted off from Wan Pat International Airport in 2003, thinking that would be the last time I would ever visit that small island. I've now lost count of the number of times I've been to Guam. I've also spent a considerable amount of time just north of Guam in the Commonwealth of Northern Mariana Islands. As you'll learn later in the book, the Department of Defense leased 2/3 of the island of Tinian in the early 80s and is now studying the placement of live fire training ranges there. I've been to Tinian over a dozen times in recent years. After a settling in period, I started to get comfortable with my job, but not so much with the Marine Corps. My sense was that the Marine Corps, in general, did not easily accept outsiders right away. The fact that I was a retired Army general meant little to the rank and file. I had to prove my value if I was to move more freely in their ranks. I had to demonstrate that I was worthy of breathing their air. I was fine with that, but it took some time. The fact is that the Marine Corps thinks they're special. And they are. From the day they first step off a bus, whether at Parris Island, South Carolina, or at Marine Corps Recruit Depot in San Diego, California, and place their feet in the yellow footprints painted on the concrete, drill instructors start a complete makeover of a recruit to mold them into a Marine. It's a special journey culminating in a field exercise affectionately called the Crucible, where the Marines pass their final field test and are presented in the mud, with the prized eagle, globe, and anchor. Only then are they a United States Marine. I ran into General Marty Dempsey in Guam a few years into the job. At the time, he was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the senior military officer in the United States. We had been contemporaries once, entering the Army about the same time and serving in the same branch, armor. While we never served together, we knew of each other. He asked me, "How do you like the Marine Corps?" "I love it," I said. Curious, he asked me to explain. I replied, "You can find every Marine along a continuum between pride and arrogance, but they'll all be there. We have what we consider elite units in the Army. The Marine Corps is an elite service." I recently saw a poster that read, "Question, how long does it take the average person to become a U.S. Marine?" Answer, an average person will never be a U.S. Marine. I believe that's absolutely true, In my view, the Marine Corps instills a sense of purpose better than any other military service. Marines view themselves, rightly so, as the nation's 911 force. They are ready to go anywhere, at any time, to do anything the nation asks. The motto of the Marine Corps Forces Pacific is, in any clime and place. And you often hear the refrain, fight tonight. That's why there is no better friend, no worse enemy, than a U.S. Marine. A quote attributed to General James Mattis on the eve of Operation Iraqi Freedom when he commanded the 1st Marine Division. About 6 or 7 months into my job, I found myself watching paint dry too often. Working mostly at the operational and strategic level, the reason I was hired, I didn't have enough to do. The build-out of the base in Guam was initially advertised to be completed by 2014, but this was a pipe dream. There was no way a multi-billion dollar project could be completed that soon. Ultimately, we realized this effort would take 10 to 15 years at the pace and resourcing stream we were told to expect. I went to my boss, then Lieutenant General Duane Drano Thiessen, and told him I could do more. I could help take some things off his plate, things that were not necessarily in my current job description. I asked him to let me speak to the staff, and I would get back to him. I then called in each staff principal, then their deputies, a civilian GS-15 or colonel equivalent, and told them that I had served in a senior position with the Army here in the Pacific and understood what this level required. While most of them didn't work directly for me, I was happy to help them whenever and however they needed it. All they had to do was come see me, wind me up, point me in the right direction, and I'd do whatever I could to help facilitate their needs, without adding another layer of bureaucracy to the process. The different staff sections took advantage of this invitation, and soon I had broadened my portfolio beyond just moving Marines from Okinawa to Guam. The extra work helped fill my days and brought me closer to being accepted as a civilian Marine, one of them. Since the Marine Corps is part of the broader Department of the Navy, I'm also closer to my Navy brethren in this job than I ever was when I served in the Army uniform. People poke fun every now and then at my Army roots, but it's all in good fun. I'm now officially agnostic each year when Army plays Navy in perhaps the greatest college football rivalry anywhere. One thing I've learned from the Marine Corps is that after having served side by side with soldiers over the past 18 years in places like Iraq, Afghanistan, and other hotspots around the world, there's a mutual respect for each other that transcends service culture. The respect goes both ways. When you experience adversity together, it brings you together. I'm proud, honored, and humbled to have been associated with both services and both cultures.
Chapter 10. How tall is your ladder? Be realistic in your expectations. I'd really like to cuddle a unicorn, but it ain't going to happen. India Night.
Before I left mid-level schooling at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, General Edward Shy Meyer, the Chief of Staff of the Army, came to visit our class, as was the habits of every chief. He was the CEO of the Army. We all crowded into what we called the Big Blue Bedroom, an auditorium with blue seats, to hear his pitch. After the presentation, he took questions. A major raised his hand and asked, "Sir, how do you define success in today's Army?" General Meyer thought for a moment, then replied, "A career in the Army is like climbing a ladder. When you stand at the bottom and look up, there are many rungs, and you may not even see the top. As you reach out to the first rung, your feet are still on the ground, and the next rung is within easy reach. As you climb, however, the rungs are further apart, the air is thinner, and you start to tire. You'll find that the higher you go, the harder it is to get to the next rung." He said we all probably thought he had had a successful career. After all, he was a 4-star general and the chief of staff of the Army. We all thought, duh. He then said he had contemporaries who, were they in his position, would be disappointed if they retired as only the Army Chief of Staff. He paused for the anticipated and confused reaction, which he got from all of us. He then came back to the ladder analogy and made the point that, even for him, there was still another rung on the ladder, the position of chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Some of his contemporaries might think it was within reach for him, yet he knew it wasn't. His point was that everyone needs to aspire to reach an achievable rung on the ladder, but we should be satisfied once we arrive there. Constantly striving to always reach the next rung is not only unhealthy, it can be at some point impossible and could result in long-held bitterness. Following his advice, I told myself that day, "Self, I want to be a battalion commander." I had several more rungs on my ladder, but once I reached my goal, I promised myself that I would keep in mind that any new achievement after that would be icing on the cake. I would do my best to excel as a battalion commander, and though I would continue to be ambitious, I would not expect to be promoted to a higher rank. We all have a last rung on the ladder, and for most of us, it is somewhere in the middle, not at the top. Aspire to reach a lofty goal and be satisfied when you arrive. I've spoken to a few colonels over the years who thought they should have been generals, but weren't selected. Some left the military bitter because they didn't get to that next rung on their ladder. Some carried this bitterness for years, and I could see the toll it took on them. They just couldn't let it go. I've tried to encourage them to reflect on the tremendous career they had up to that point and to look forward to the many great opportunities still ahead. Then I tell them, find a new ladder to climb.
Chapter 11. The 1% Advantage.
Life isn't about finding yourself. It's about creating yourself. George Bernard Shaw. After the last chapter, cynics might accuse me of suggesting you set a low bar and be satisfied once you get there. This chapter aims to clarify my point further and encourage you to be the best that you can be in whatever you do. Always. It's about setting realistic expectations, and then not being dissatisfied if you don't get to the next rung on the ladder after you reach your original goal. But because most of you are likely type A high achievers, I'd like to focus in this chapter on what separates the good from great, and the great from the really great. Citing a 2017 article by James Clear, The 1% Rule: Why a Few People Get Most of the Rewards. You can find this article on his website. In his article, Clear describes a 19th century Italian named Pareto, who becomes curious about why just a few pea pods in his garden produced most of the peas. He was a mathematician and happened to be also studying why the wealthy seemed to have an easier time of becoming even wealthier. He discovered that in Italy, 80% of the land was owned by just 20% of the people, and in England, 70% of the total income was earned by 30% of Brits. This idea that most of the rewards go to a small group was found to be valid across a number of areas. Pareto published a theory in the early 20th century that has come to be known as the Pareto Principle, or more commonly, the 80-20 rule. If you apply the Pareto Principle to today, this phenomena is borne out in a number of ways. Why do the rich get richer? For most of us, we're taught at an early age the miracle of compounding when we begin investing. Simply put, $10,000 hidden under a mattress or buried in the ground for 30 years will still be only $10,000, actually less when you consider inflation. But if the $10,000 is invested at 7% interest over a 30-year period and compounded monthly, it will be worth over $81,000. This is why rich people don't hide money under their mattress. You shouldn't either. Why do athletes get million-dollar endorsement contracts for doing little more than lending their name to a product? Why do speakers who are famous, or infamous, get astronomical speaking fees when they really aren't very good speakers? Why do well-known authors get huge advances on their planned books before they've even put pen to paper? Note, no advance for this book. Why is it that so much wealth and reward is concentrated in a disproportionately small group of people? Clear explains the reason in his article,